All right, this is CS50 week 10. And you recall that last time we introduced one of our additional languages in CS50, that of SQL, Structured Query Language. And this, recall, was a language that we used to query databases, insert data into databases, delete, update, and more, so that we actually have a way of persisting data once we've built a web-based application, or really any other application, that we want to be able to store data long term. And we had such statements as create for creating a database or a table, insert, select, update, delete, and a few others as well. And with these relatively few building blocks, were we able to start building a back end for a web service. And indeed, weeks ago, when we first implemented a front end for Google, simply by implementing that web form, we didn't really have anything to do with the data or anywhere to query for data. But now we actually do via our own database in the form of SQLite and via this new language, SQL itself. But today, we introduce really the last of our formal languages in CS50. You'll recall that we began the semester with Scratch, transitioning quickly thereafter to C, where we spent a lot of the semester. We have since pivoted to Python, of course, whose syntax is quite different, but whose ideas are really fundamentally the same. Today, we transition to JavaScript. And JavaScript, you'll find, is more syntactically similar probably to C than it is to Python itself. So you'll see that a few more parentheses are back, perhaps some semicolons as well. But what's most important today is that really the fundamentals of programming aren't changing, but rather the method via which we actually execute or run this code. In particular, thus far, when we've written C code, when we've written Python code, all of that code has run on the server, so to speak, within CS50 IDE, or maybe on your own Mac or your own PC if you have some prior programming experience. But today we introduce a language that is generally, though not always, used within the client, the browser, which is to say the code that we start writing today, and when you generally use JavaScript in order to create front-end user interfaces, you will find that the code you write, like HTML or CSS, is actually sent to the user's browser where it's executed, again, client-side. On the Mac, on the PC, it is not executed server-side. Now, to be fair, JavaScript can be and is increasingly used on the server-side as well via frameworks called Node.js, if not others. But we'll focus predominantly on client-side usage thereof. And you'll see that you can start to do some pretty powerful things, because not only now do we have the ability to have a dynamic backend that serves up data and searches things for us, but a front end that gives us all the better user interface and features still. So I was thinking back yesterday on when I first started using JavaScript, and it was in a very, very small, isolated instance. But way back in the day, and this is thanks to the Wayback Machine, you may recall Frosh IMs was something I did in college, not so much the sports, but more the website. And this was essentially the layout, of the Frosh IMs website some years ago. Now, this actually postdates me by a few years, since it seems the code base actually survived me by quite a few years, surprisingly. But early on, when you would hover over these menu options at top right, those would have what are called event listeners attached to them, so that when you hover over some of those menu options, the color would actually change. And I think they shifted position slightly. So Lee Feigenbaum ultimately took over the site and took it further than that. But this was my first taste of JavaScript. And it was just to give the website a sense of dynamism and to give it a sense of interactivity that wasn't possible, certainly not at the time, with HTML alone. So let's do a quick compare and contrast of JavaScript with things we've seen in the past, just to kind of bring ourselves up to speed on some of the syntax. But you'll find we need to spend relatively little time on the syntax and the language itself, because you'll find syntactically it's so similar. And so instead, we'll focus more on ideas and new features of the language itself. So as in C and in Python, we have the ability to express functions in JavaScript. They look a little bit different, at least at first glance, but fundamentally, they're really the same. In JavaScript, if we want a function, we are going to use the keyword function to say, hey, browser, here comes a function, followed by the function's name, zero or more parameters, and then between the curly braces, a bit of code that implements that function. So gone is the ability to just indent your code and have the interpreter know what you mean. Those curly braces are back, as are more parentheses for us here in JavaScript. But in terms of loops, you should find this fairly familiar. In JavaScript, if you want to iterate over something again and again and again, the do while construct is actually back. So we have something something very similar here as we do in C. And what you use that loop for can be any number of things, but we do have that capability again. Similarly, do we have while or a while true loop here, which would induce an infinite loop? And again, these are the kinds of things that might trip you up unnecessarily at first, but quite reasonably, like if you start capitalizing true again, it's not going to work in JavaScript. So again, reasonable people will disagree when it comes to designing these languages. And so the authors of JavaScript decided to lowercase true and false, where again, in Python, we've been capitalizing recently true and false. Meanwhile, if you want to declare a loop using a for loop, that is back. But you'll notice perhaps implicit in this example is the fact that JavaScript is like Python, not strongly typed. It does have the notion of data types. And you can access or look at those data types, but you don't have to specify them as the programmer when you're declaring variables. Rather, in the case like this, when you're declaring a counter like I, which should be an integer from 0 up to 50, you literally say var for variable, then the name you want to declare, and then just the rest of the syntax is as we've seen before. Meanwhile, there's another handy feature, and we'll see this, you'll see this in use in various examples perhaps online, is the very easy ability, like in Python, to iterate over the keys in an object. So recall that an object, at least in Python, is really just a collection of key value pairs. But an object can also have methods inside of it. But if we focus entirely on data, keys and values, this syntax here would allow you to iterate over all of the keys in some value coming back. So maybe if you have a stock object, you could iterate over its name and its price and its symbol simply by using syntax like this, and then index into the object to get at that object's value. Meanwhile, variables are fairly straightforward. To declare a variable like I, we would say var I equals 0 and a semicolon. Boolean expressions, meanwhile, are with us still, and these are no different. I is less than 50 might be expressed with this. X is less than y might be expressed with this. So nothing new there. Meanwhile, with conditions, we have syntax that's identical to C. So again, the curly braces are necessary, at least if you have multiple lines that you intend to be associated with the if or the else. Again, we're back to else space if instead of elif in Python. But again, there's nothing really new here in terms of content, really just syntax. So after practice and after some trial and error, you'll generally find that it becomes second nature. Meanwhile, we have arrays in JavaScript. So for instance, if we want to declare an array called numbers, again, we don't specify the type of this array or the members therein. We simply say var to give us a variable. Numbers shall be the name of that variable. And then a list here of arbitrary numbers themselves nested in between square brackets. So in JavaScript, as we've seen in Python, we have the ability to express lists or arrays specifically in JavaScript that simply use square bracket notation to define them in a context like this. Meanwhile, speaking of objects a moment ago, we have that same ability in JavaScript to declare them. So for instance, if we wanted to declare an object, and we'll call it quote, we use, as in Python, curly braces. And I say as in Python because in Python, really, when I say object, focusing entirely on data, I really mean a Python dictionary or dict object, which again is this collection of key value pairs. We don't necessarily do things quite the same way, but in this case here, var quote is a way of porting, say from a CS50 finance example, a company's name and its price and its symbol. And worth noting here that as in Python, you actually have choice over the quotes that you use, at least in this context. Single quotes are fine, double quotes are fine. So long as you are stylistically consistent, it's probably fair to say that many people in the JavaScript community tend to use single quotes here. There's no functional difference as there is in C. However, they do matter, as you'll perhaps eventually see, when you're using not JavaScript per se, but JSON notation, JavaScript object notation, which is a simple data format, not unlike CSV, but that allows you to store a hierarchical data inside of an object. And the subtlety there is that when you want to store data in this JSON format, you have to quote literally everything with specifically double quotes on the left and on the right. So it's an annoying distinction. And don't fret too much about it now. But just realize any time we're talking about JSON and a technology called AJAX, more on that soon, it's got to look like this with the double quotes on both sides of the colons for those key value pairs. Now, with that said, let's start to give ourselves some context. Let me introduce a few features that we've kind of sort of seen in Python, didn't necessarily leverage, but are going to be really integral to the way in which many people use JavaScript within browsers. So here, for instance, is that old simple example of HTML, perhaps the simplest web page that we can write, that quite simply says, in its title and in its body, hello world. And recall that the indentation here is functionally meaningless. The browser doesn't really care how pretty your HTML looks, just nicer for us humans to see everything nested and nicely indented, because it's just a lot easier to read. And it's also a lot easier to detect if you type something wrong, if something doesn't really line up as you expect. But another way, recall, of viewing this same piece of HTML is in the form of a data structure, like a tree, which we discussed way back when within the context of C. And we might draw this same example of HTML with a DOM, document object model, which is a fancy way of saying tree. And that tree might look like this. It's got some special root node that we'll just generically call document, because there might actually be some other stuff like comments or whatever up there. But the root element of a web page, recall, is HTML. The second thing you type is open bracket HTML. The first thing you should type with HTML5 is open bracket doc type HTML. So you can think of the doc type as meaning this node, essentially, and the open bracket HTML close bracket meaning this root element. Of course, this page here has both a head and a body. That head has a title, and that title has a text value inside of it, or a text node, so to speak, as does the body that happens to be identical. So what's nice about this mental model is that if we tie everything together from weeks past, sort of the markup language of HTML and the data structure of trees, and specifically this DOM here, it turns out that you have the ability with JavaScript, something we didn't have in C really, and didn't really have with Python, but the ability to change this tree in real time. After a browser has downloaded some HTML from a server, typically that content has been static. You can open up Chrome's console and the Elements tab and futz with it manually, but those changes aren't persistent, even though you see them. And certainly no user or no typical user is going to do or know to do that. But you, the programmer, if you want a user to be able to download some web page, but then interact with it and have that content change, very similar in spirit to something like Gmail, whereby every time you get an email, a new row in your inbox appears without the whole page having to reload, and certainly without you having to click reload, or something like Facebook Messenger, where no matter the time of day, if you have the Facebook, if you have Facebook open in a tab, it's just going to pop up a message and keep adding to that little window another line, another line, another line of text. So there's this dynamism you get that you can't get from HTML and CSS alone, but you can with JavaScript. If you think of it just intuitively, if you have the ability to run code inside of a user's browser, you could have essentially kind of a while loop that's just constantly waiting. Did the server send me more data? Did the server send me more data? And if so, go ahead with an if condition and write more text to the web page. Write another message in the little Facebook chat message. Write another row to the Gmail inbox. And that's what we're going to get and more with JavaScript. And it turns out, with JavaScript, can we listen for a whole bunch of events, so to speak? I alluded to an event, a listener being attached earlier. And this is just a small sample of the events that can be triggered within the confines of a web page. So unlike our Python programming thus far, and unlike our C programming, we have in JavaScript this asynchronicity. Multiple things can kind of sort of happen at the same time, or really at unpredictable times, because users, of course, are interacting now with our web pages. And who knows when or where a user is going to click? Who knows when he or she is going to click and drag something across the screen, or select some menu option, or check some checkbox? So we can't really just write a program top to bottom in JavaScript, as we've done in this past, per se. Rather, we have to start writing code that says, if I hear a mouse click, or if the user drags their mouse, or if the user checks a checkbox, do something. So kind of like if this, then that, if this, then that, so a lot of conditions. But it turns out that it's relatively simple to register functions, that is, associate functions with these various events. And so for instance, when you check a box in Gmail and all of a sudden the row becomes a different color or whatnot, that's because there's an event listener for the click event that Gmail is saying, as soon as the user clicks this event, go ahead and change the color or change the interface in some way. Or if you click the little X in the top right-hand corner of a Facebook chat window, the reason it goes away is because there's a click event happening. And Facebook has written code that listens for that click event. And as soon as they hear that event, they close the window and remove it from the web page altogether. So Google Maps, for instance, drag is an event. So if you've ever kind of wondered, well, how do I click and drag in Google Maps and they just know to show me more of the map, whatever direction I'm clicking in, they're listening for the drag event. And so this is where things get really interesting with GUI side programming, graphical user interface programming. There's this whole event model where a bunch of events, a bunch of things can happen at any number of times or at any point in time. So let's offer a few general definitions of terms and features of JavaScript, but let's actually discuss them in the context of examples. So JavaScript supports and really, really leverages typically things called anonymous functions, otherwise known as lambda functions. And these, quite simply, are functions that have no name. And that seems a little strange, but we will see contexts in which functions don't need names if you're only going to call them once, or if you only need to refer to them really once. So we'll see how to declare and define a function that doesn't actually have a name like foo or bar or whatever. Meanwhile, we're going to see a methodology involving callbacks, which is very similar in spirit to the events I rattled off a moment ago, whereby a callback is just a function that's supposed to get called when something happens. So in other words, Google and Facebook with those user interfaces, they are registering functions. Really, they are registering callbacks so that when the user clicks on an X, or when the user clicks on a checkbox, or when the user clicks and drags on a map, they have in advance registered a function that gets called back. It's like leaving a message for someone on voicemail. They call you back in response to that voicemail. They call you back in response to the beep that their phone makes when they receive that. So it triggers some kind of functionality, these callbacks. Callbacks are just functions that have been configured to be called at a certain point in time when something happens. Now, meanwhile, and lastly, we'll talk about Ajax, which isn't a technology unto itself, but a use of various existing features within browsers that allow you to query from a browser, a server, to get more data even after the original page has been loaded. Let me go ahead here and create a file called, say, dom0.html, documentObject0.html, just to line up with some of the examples that we'll place online for everyone to play with. I'm going to go ahead and start my page, as I usually do. And I'm going to go ahead and say HTML. And then in here, I'm going to have a head tag. And in here, I'm going to have a title tag. And I'm just going to call this DOM0 for simplicity. Down here, I'm going to have a body tag. And in here, I'm going to have a form. I'm going to give this form, similar in spirit to as we did in our discussions of CSS, a unique ID, simply so that I can refer to it as a demo, a demonstration. But let's come back to what more I want to associate with that. First, let me go ahead and give it an input, an ID of name, so that I can refer specifically to this input field. Let me give it a placeholder of name. And let me say that the type of this field is a text field. Close that tag. And then input type equals submit. So a very, very simple web page that looks like this. Now, what could go wrong if I present a user with a web page like this? Well, he or she might not give me their name. They might just click submit, and this form is going to get submitted to some server. Well, that doesn't seem all that great, because I don't have a chance to check, did they actually type in a name? I don't have a chance to do something with it on the client. And indeed, that's now the new feature we get with JavaScript. Notice what I can actually do. Let me go into the head of this web page, where thus far we've pretty much only put the title tag, we've put the link tag for CSS, and you may have seen with CS50 Finance that we also had a script tag that referenced a library called Bootstrap and another one called jQuery. More on those in a bit. But indeed, inside of the head of a web page can go a script tag. And you know what? Inside of a script tag can go code, specifically JavaScript. And in here, I can define a function, literally. I'm going to call it greet, just to kind of say what it does. And inside of this function, I'm going to do the following. Alert, quote unquote, hello, comma, world, semicolon. So this is how, in this example, I've defined a function called greet. I've put it inside script tags, open and closed, inside of the head of this web page. Now, nothing's going to happen with that unless I tell the browser to do it on an event. So I'm going to go into my form tag here and say on submit, go ahead and execute the following code. Go ahead and call the greet method and greet function, and just for good measure, return false. But more on that in a moment. So again, my function's defined up top, but nothing happens. Again, when you define a function, nothing automatically happens until you call it. So when am I going to call it? On the form tag here, I have an onSubmit attribute, which is new today, that says call the greet function and then return false. But again, more on that in just a moment. So what actually happens here? Let me go into another window, open up DOM 0, and you'll see, if I now zoom in on this form, we'll see that it's a very simple HTML form with just a name field and a submit box. And if I go ahead now and type in my name, David, and click submit, hello world. So it's not actually saying hello David, it's just saying hello world. But notice what happened. This is a very bad user interface just using this built-in prompt. But it demonstrates that built into JavaScript are a bunch of functions, one of which is alert. And that function is designed to do exactly this. The window will look a little different if you're using Chrome or Edge or Firefox or Safari or whatever other browser. But you'll see that it simply says hello world. And it's going to say whatever the URL on your page happens to be. In my case, it's just this local IP address, for lecture's sake. But this isn't all that interesting to just hard code hello world, especially when I have the opportunity to take in a user's name. So if I instead go back into my code here and don't just print out hello world, but perhaps concatenate with JavaScript's plus operator, the result of this method call, document.getElementById, quote unquote, name, then dot value. So that's a mouthful. Let's see what this does before we explain what it does. Let me go ahead and reload the page. And now we see the same form again. But this time I'm going to type in David and click submit. And now it says, hello, David. So how does this work? Somehow or other, I wrote code that not only alerts the user with this window, but it somehow grabs data that he or she has typed in and embeds it in this message. Well, here is where we can leverage the DOM, the document object model, and a bunch of functions that come with JavaScript that allow you to programmatically get elements and get data, ultimately, from a web page. Specifically, notice we're doing this. We're calling alert, and then open paren, close paren, because it's a function call, quote unquote hello, comma, with a space. And again, single quotes, double quotes, doesn't matter, so long as I'm consistent here, plus, which is concatenation, document.getElementById, quote unquote name, dot value. So it's kind of a mouthful, and it's definitely verbose. And we'll see before long slightly more succinct ways of expressing this. But you can think of document as being this special global variable that's just accessible to JavaScript code that you write. And that really is that uppermost node in our tree, that topmost node in our DOM. And associated with that node, which is just an object, are a bunch of methods or functions that just come with JavaScript and that your browser just supports for you. One of those is called getElementById. And recall, we've used this jargon before. An element in a web page is the combination of an open tag and a closed tag and everything in between it. So getElementById, quote unquote, name means, hey, browser, go get me this entire element from start to finish. And this is an empty element because we've closed it within its own tag. So that just means go get me kind of a pointer to that node in the tree. There's no pointers in JavaScript, so we should really call this like a reference to this node. But it really just means that. Go get me somehow this node in the tree. And what do I care about once I have that node? I care about its value. So dot value, you can think of like syntax like a struct. That means if you have this node now, via getElementById, go inside of it and look for the field or the property called value. And that's going to line up, it turns out, with exactly what the user types. So I can do this again to be clear. Let me go up here and, for instance, type in Andy and click submit. And voila, now it says, hello, Andy. But now the browser, and this is perhaps a curse from 10 and 20 years ago when people started to abuse JavaScript and give you hundreds of popovers, so to speak, hundreds of prompts if you visit a website that's trying to mess with you. Chrome and other browsers will let you check a box like this, prevent this page from creating additional dialogues, just because it thinks that maybe the page is buggy, maybe it's malicious, isn't really just pestering you, as these things are annoying. But at least during CS50 development for psets and projects, don't check this, because it'll only confuse if the page no longer does as you tell it to do. Fortunately, that doesn't come up too often on actual websites. All right, so we seem then to have the ability to not only get data from a web page programmatically and display it dynamically, but can we design this code a little better? Well, it turns out that we technically don't need to commingle our code and our HTML. And notice, too, there's one other line of code here that's a little sloppy. I mean, literally between these double quotes do I have two statements, greet, which is a function call, and then return false. The reason I had return false is that if I didn't, after clicking submit and submitting this form, the only thing stopping this form from just being submitted to the server is return false. This says, hey, browser, even when the user tries to submit this form, don't return false. the default is true. Otherwise, if I didn't have return false and I clicked submit, I would see that alert as expected. But the moment I dismiss it, I'm going to be led to some other web page, presumably wherever the form is going to be submitted, which coincidentally happens to be the same page. But now that we're developing client-side applications, client-side web apps, we don't necessarily want forms to be submitted to the server. We want to use them, for now, only within the confines of a browser. Indeed, there is no backend. There is no action attribute for this particular example. But this feels messy, right? Anytime in CS50 when we've introduced some new language, like CSS in the context of HTML, or our HTML in the context of Python via our Jinja templates, did we try to factor out one language from another so as not to blur these worlds and make the code very messy, very unmaintainable? So how can we begin to remove from these quoted values code, but still have this feature of listening for a form submission? Well, let me go ahead and propose another variant of this program that I'll go ahead and call DOM1.html. I'm going to start with the code from before, but I'm going to make a few changes. Instead of putting it in the head of my web page for now, I'm actually going to put it down here in the body. More on that soon. But instead of even declaring this as a function, I'm going to instead simply do this. I'm going to get rid of this event handler. So now all that remains up here, to be clear, is just pure HTML. I still have those ID attributes so that I can uniquely identify those forms and those that form and those inputs if I want, or that input if I want. But notice what I can do now. Document.getElementById, quote unquote demo, because that's the name of my form, dot on submit gets function, open paren, close paren. And then just for stylistic purposes, let me go ahead and do this, which is what most JavaScript programmers would do. So what am I doing now? Now I have pure HTML up here. But to be fair, I now have a script tag inside of which is code. But at least I've removed the code from like an attribute which just looked or felt a little sloppy. And look at the code now. Document.getElementById demo. So this gives me essentially a reference to the entire form, not just that name field. And it turns out that provided that node in the tree is a form, and indeed it is, that has associated with it a property, by the definition of HTML5, called onSubmit. This is a property that if you assign it the value of a function, that function will get called when the form is submitted. And yet, what function do I want to call? Well, function open paren close paren seems to omit a key detail that we've seen in Python and C, which is the name of the function. But here's an example where I don't care what the name of this function is. I don't need to know the name of this function, because all I need is a function, a chunk of code that will ultimately get executed when this form is submitted. And that line of code is identical to what it was before. So just to be clear, this anonymous function, so to speak, that I'm using is not strictly necessary. If I really wanted to do, I could do something like this. I could declare a function called greet, just as before, and I'll format it exactly as I did before. And I could declare this right up here. And then down here, I could say greet. In other words, the onSubmit handler just wants to know what function to call. So fine, if I find a function called greet, I can tell onSubmit to call greet. Notice, no parentheses here. I don't want to call the greet function when that line of code is executed. Rather, I want to assign that function, which you can think of as a variable unto itself, to this onSubmit handler. But like, why? This hasn't really gained me anything. Yes, it's nice that it's called greet, but I'm defining a function called greet only to configure my browser to call that function one line later. The nice thing about anonymous functions is that you can just kind of tighten things up. Why clutter your namespace, so to speak? Why fill up your brain with names of functions that you're never again going to need? And so more common and cleaner, better design, arguably, would be something like this. All right. And actually, just for good measure, because this is all part of a statement, in this example, let me put that semicolon there. So the example is going to work exactly the same. Indeed, if I go back to my browser and go into DOM1.html and type in something like summer and click submit, hello, summer. and so it behaves exactly as before. And for good measure, let me go ahead and change the title here to match the name of the file. But now let me go ahead and open up an example I wrote in advance, like many of these, called dom2.html, the code for which admittedly is much more cryptic at first glance. And indeed, the syntax will take some getting used to, and you don't strictly need to do things this way, but a super popular library in the world of JavaScript today, to this day, is something called jQuery. And indeed, the Bootstrap library, with which you're now acquainted via CS50 Finance, actually uses, for some of its features, the jQuery library. So let's introduce the syntax so that you've seen it, so that you can use it, but realize this is not giving us any new functionality. It's just giving us a different syntax. And over time, you'll see that jQuery, like certain other libraries, tends to make it more pleasurable, more efficient to write JavaScript because you can do things a little more succinctly. The price you pay is a little bit of complexity. So let's take a look syntactically at this library called jQuery. Notice in dom2.html, I have this URL up here. There's any number of places to get the jQuery library and libraries more generally, but this one happens to be hosted, for instance, at this URL, and it's the latest version thereof. And this attribute source simply says, hey, browser, go get the JavaScript code that I want to have access to from this URL and assume that it's equivalent to my having written it in this web page itself, like our other script tags thus far. Meanwhile, after that, an order is generally important when including things like this. Let me go ahead and do the following. Up here, notice that I have this line of code, which generally is a good thing to have because it says the following to the browser. Hey, browser, when the document is ready, that is, when the whole web page has been loaded, when all the bytes have come back from the server, please go ahead and execute the following code. And we'll see that this allows us to ensure that things don't happen sooner than we actually expect. Specifically, let's do the following. When the document is ready, I want the browser to execute the following lines of code that I've highlighted here. Dollar sign, quote unquote, hash demo. It's kind of a mouthful, but this is simply reminiscent, perhaps, of the CSS syntax with which you might be familiar that simply says, hey, browser, go get me the element from the DOM, from the tree representing this page that has a unique ID of demo. So hashtag demo is just a more succinct way of saying document.getElementById. You can do this all in just a few characters, and the dollar sign here is a feature of jQuery. It's actually just a synonym of for jQuery. Dollar signs can actually be variable names. So dollar sign quote unquote hash demo means, hey browser, execute the equivalent of document.getElementById quote unquote demo. Just more succinct, even though it's a little bit cryptic at first glance. Meanwhile, submit, not to be confused with onSubmit, submit is a function that per jQuery's documentation says, hey browser, register the following event handler for the submit event. The way you do this is you provide the library with an anonymous function, which in this case, I just said function. It takes one argument, and I would only know this from having read the documentation. Function takes an argument that we'll call event, but we call it anything we want. And then inside of this code, what do I want to do when the demo form is submitted? Well, I want to use alert, but I want to paste in this value. So again, just new syntax here, and it's fine if you prefer the other syntax for now. Dollar sign, quote unquote, hash name means go get the element from the DOM that has a unique ID of name and go get its value using this method call. So jQuery essentially does this. jQuery wraps existing elements in a DOM. It goes ahead and adds like another bigger rectangle around those smaller rectangles that give you additional features, among which is the ability to use these CSS style selectors, among whose features is to call like .val and get the value without having to do .value, which isn't all that compelling in this case. And then we're appending, in this case, an exclamation point for good measure, just so that we can continue to concatenate beyond one string. And then lastly is this, which granted, more verbose, event.preventDefault just means, hey, browser, whatever your default behavior is for handling forms, don't do it. Prevent it, because I want to handle this form submission. So this is a really long way of saying this is another way to implement exactly the same program that we did earlier, albeit with an added exclamation point, which has nothing to do here with jQuery. So why is this a good thing overall? Well, one, your code will actually get shorter over time, but it's fine if you'd rather not use this. But this first line was actually rather important. If I instead were to implement this code like this, there's actually a problem. And actually, there's a problem even if I were to do it this way. If I were to go back to DOM 1 and I were to do something like this in this example, and not use jQuery at all, but just in my head tag, have a script tag that has this code here, there's a problem of order of operations. On this first line, when I say document.getElementById, quote unquote, demo.onSubmit, assign that event, assign that listener this function, it's too soon. Because the browser at this point in the story literally is reading the file top to bottom, left to right, and the browser has not gotten to the line of code where in this form and its demo ID is actually defined. So this would actually be broken insofar as the browser's reading it top to bottom, left to right, but it sees this code and it says, hey, browser, go get the element by ID demo. There is no element with that ID at this moment because it doesn't come until later. So a way of solving this using just JavaScript is you could do something like the following, window.onload gets function, and then you could do something like this, albeit fairly verbosely. So that would work. Hey, browser, when the whole window is loaded, then please call this anonymous function. Or we can use jQuery, which frankly tends to be more common, at least when using